Liquid water lakes under the Martian South Pole? Maybe not. This week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Mars Odyssey project scientist Jeff Plaut is back, this time joined by York University's Isaac Smith. They have contributed to a new explanation for those radar reflections from the Martian South Pole that we, well, I hoped were big pools of water. Jeff and Isaac will tell us we're not yet sure they aren't, but our excitement back in 2018 may have been misplaced. And we'll wrap up by looking up with Planetary Society Chief Scientist Bruce Betts. What is that striking image atop the August 27 edition of the Downlake? It's a gift from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. We're looking at sand dunes in the north polar region of the Red Planet. You can check out the surreal surface at planetary.org/downlink. Elsewhere in this edition, you'll read about a big milestone for the James Webb Space Telescope. With testing complete, it's ready for a trip through the Panama Canal for its launch from French Guiana as early as November. Mars rover Perseverance has made it to the Citadel, a rocky outcrop where the robot will make its second attempt to collect a sample. And Blue Origin sent another New Shepard capsule above the Kármán line. No passengers this time, just a variety of experiments and thousands of postcards from students. Is Mars Earth-like? Well, kind of. But once upon a time, it was much more like our own warm, wet world. Scientists have found lots of evidence for this past state of grace, including the water ice that lurks below the surface. But is there still liquid water somewhere on Mars? Remember the recurring slope lineae, or RSLs? Those downhill dark cascades that appear quite suddenly are now thought to just be newly exposed sand, with no more than a tiny bit of moisture at best. Okay, but those radar pings bouncing off salty lakes under the South Pole? Jeff Plaut of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and Isaac Smith of York University in Toronto are among the researchers who may have thrown a dry towel on this interpretation. Jeff joined us in November of last year when he and Rich Zurek helped us celebrate Mars Odyssey and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, two of the oldest spacecraft circling the Red Planet. Jeff is also co-principal investigator for the radar on the European Space Agency's Mars Express Orbiter, the same radar that delivered those tantalizing data in 2018. And as you'll hear, Isaac has been simulating the conditions under the ice in his lab. Jeff Plaut, Isaac Smith, thank you very much for joining us on Planetary Radio. Jeff, of course, welcoming you back. Isaac, very happy to have you make your first appearance on our show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's very exciting to talk to you.
Yep, and I'm glad to be here as well.
And I'm going to warn everybody that in case we hear a small child, a baby crying, there's good reason for that. Isaac is still a fairly new dad, and so there may be some fatherly advice offered during the program, as well as talking about what is going on at the poles of the Red Planet. Guys, I told you what I put in my newsletter when I was letting people know about this conversation coming up. The line I used was disappointing, yes, but each new data point takes us closer to understanding the true nature and potential of our solar system. But it is kind of disappointing. I mean, you had to come up with this data, right?
It is disappointing. It wasn't my intention or my team's intention to play spoiler to the fun. It just happens that we think there's a better explanation for this than liquid water. It doesn't mean that there's no liquid water on Mars. I think we haven't found it yet. So we're going to keep looking. That's part of the goals of these missions. Again, we always want to get closer to the truth. Understanding our solar system, understanding each planet is really the goal here. Flashy headlines isn't really nice, but it doesn't mean that we haven't gotten closer. So the goal is that.
Jeff, I saw a quote from you that said pretty much the same thing, that we are often inching our way toward the truth in planetary science. This seems like a great example.
Yeah, I think so. And I think Isaac and I are of a like mind on this, that the presentation of hypotheses, whether they're mundane or extraordinary, that's how science works, is that you put these things on the table and you study them carefully, you present your evidence, and sometimes somebody else might come along and have a different idea. It's not proven that either interpretation is the correct one, at least not yet. We use this term frequently in planetary sciences. We're putting constraints around a problem. We're trying to narrow the possibilities of the solution space. And I think maybe that's what's happening here.
Before we get into the details of what actually may have been found by the two of you and many other researchers, or at least where the evidence seems to be pointing now, what will it take to really answer this question? Are we going to have to go someday and drill down through the ice at the pole?
I think that would be a fantastic mission. I'd love to get core samples of the ice. And as long as you're getting cores, going to get the bottom would be really very interesting. So that's something we can think of very long term. I don't think it's going to happen in the next decade or two decades, unfortunately.
Yeah, doubtful. But would that be the way? Will we not really have the answer until we can dig down like that, Jeff?
Well, you're asking for the ultimate truth, the answer. And I'm not sure if we ever get there. You know, certainly, yeah, without sampling and actually touching the water, you can never be sure that there's water there. But there are some mission proposals out there to visit these terrains and to look at the ice that's exposed near the surface and maybe drill down some modest depth, but not kilometers, to where these reflective patches are. But I think that would take us a long way towards understanding what materials might be responsible.
All right, let's back up now, back to 2018. And Jeff, we'll stick with you because you are the co-principal investigator for this instrument on Mars Express called MARSIS, the Mars Advanced Radar for Subsurface and Ionospheric Sounding. The other co-principal investigator, your colleague, Roberto Orose, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, he's the one who first used this radar and saw these interesting reflections, right?
Well, yes. The thing that was new was not so much that these strong reflections were detected, but it was their analysis and their interpretation.
Huh. This really does, from this point on, after that announcement was made and people like me became so excited, it really is a great story of how science works, how it is supposed to work. Because wasn't it not long after that that others, like you, I assume, Isaac, started to wonder, could there be other explanations for what we seem to be seeing, for this interpretation anyway?
That's absolutely true. Almost immediately, the scientific community became skeptical, and the first paper that came out was in the same year, questioning, can we even get to a temperature that would allow the ice to melt? How much salt would be required? Earth and Mars have heat coming out, but from what we know, Mars doesn't produce enough heat, so it would have to be a local heat source. And it really made the whole story more complicated than just we found liquid water. And from that, the community kept thinking on it, you know, chewing on it. And in 2020, in January, we had a meeting in Patagonia in South America. And I was one of the main organizers for that. And the question came up, you know, what are we going to do about this? Are we going to test it? How are we going to test it? Who's going to test it? And so we've been thinking about it as a community for all those years.
Jeff, was it after that meeting, or were you already beginning to use MARSIS and do even more radar sounding of these polar regions? I read about work that you did with a doctoral student.
Yeah, so the recent publication was by a graduate student, Addie Culler, and he's at Arizona State University, and he was doing some internships with us at JPL, and that allowed us to collaborate on this. Yeah, I've been looking at this problem in several different ways for many years. One of the new tools that we had at our disposal just recently was to take all of the data that MARSIS had collected over the South Pole and also the North Pole and compile it all into basically a three-dimensional image, a three-dimensional image volume of the polar mountain, basically, the polar mound. This allowed us to map everywhere, basically we have such good coverage in the polar regions because it's a polar orbiting spacecraft that this compilation of literally thousands of different observations allowed us to make very detailed, complete maps of this boundary at the base of the ice where it's in contact with the rocky Mars surface. And that's the target that we're all interested in for this study.
So what did you find in the data that made you think, gee, this may not be liquid water?
Well, we didn't really take a position on the water question. We were really in the data collection mode and reporting on the sum total of the MARSIS observations rather than just picking and choosing small little bits. What we found was that there were literally dozens of areas at the base of the ice where the reflective signatures in the radar are comparable to what was reported as a potentially liquid water. Not only were there many locations, but many of these locations were at very shallow depths near the edge of the ice cap, where we know the surface temperatures are extremely low. And if you are only going a few hundred meters below that extremely cold surface temperature, you really can't find a temperature that's warm enough to even keep very salty water liquid.
So even with the perchlorates and other stuff up there, which would act like antifreeze, it just wouldn't make sense to see liquid.
That's right. In these particular locations, you have to invoke a few more kind of extraordinary processes, like some kind of a thermally insulating blanket of material or something like that. It's just things that we don't really have any evidence of.
While you were attacking this from that direction, other researchers were coming at it in other ways. And Isaac, I think of what you were doing in your lab. There is a great photo of you all bundled up because you're working with liquid nitrogen. I guess it made the room pretty cold up there in Toronto. Tell us about what you were after as a possible explanation of this, if it wasn't liquid water, if it isn't liquid water.
So I didn't go into it looking for another explanation. Actually, this was like so many things in science. I was looking at something else, and that inspired me on this topic. I was working with a graduate student named Craig Reza. Craig was looking at clays at Valles Marineris. That's the largest canyon in the solar system. It's on Mars. And we were looking at reflections there. In order to study those, we were looking at the reflections in the lab using some of the equipment we have. And the reflections we found in that equipment with these clays was very bright. And he was able to extract the dielectric properties. That's the numbers that we use to characterize these materials. And he showed them to me, and I said, that's exactly in the range that we'd expect to find to answer this question on lakes on Mars.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so often science works that way. You're thinking about something else, and it gives you an idea. And that happened in January, and by March, we had submitted the paper. The story is that there's several types of clays on Mars. One of the clays is found over a large part of the surface. Curiosity has found it, is drilled into it. We can see it from orbit with spectrometers. And so it's not a stretch of the imagination to say that there's clays on Mars. We see them. We can see them with our cameras. The story is that we have this type of clay that exists on Earth and on Mars. We can measure it in the lab and see, oh, the numbers here are really high. That makes sense then, so that we would model it, and we find out that the reflection strength we would get, which is what we measure with the radar, is exactly in the ballpark, within very tight constraints of what we'd expect to see. What we see in the lab matches very closely to what we do see. And then the last part of it, so I was working with a colleague at Purdue University, Bryony Horgan. I asked her, Bryony, can you help me find smectites there? And she found them right on the edge of the South Pole, just sticking out there. It's perfect. You know, it's a 1-2-3. We show that this can do it. We do it in the lab. We measure it. And then she goes and finds it. And it was just this really great compilation.
I think of, Jeff, how Mars Odyssey, going on, 21 years now, that venerable spacecraft, is still unveiling the planet to us.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of stories there. One is just the remarkable engineering feat of keeping a robot like that alive and working for over 20 years. It's been over 20 years since we launched Mars Odyssey, and in just a few months will be the 20th anniversary of arrival at Mars. Not only the spacecraft, but the science instruments, in particular the camera system Themis, is working exactly the same as it did when it rolled out of the the development lab. I mean, it's working perfectly. And the same goes for Marsys. Marsys has been in space since 2003 and shows absolutely no signs of degradation or wear. So hats off to these engineers who build these instruments. You know, we on the science side, we are very demanding of them. We tell them what we want and all the incredible things we want these instruments to do. We don't usually say, oh, and by the way, can you make it last 20 years? But that's what they did. So yeah, quite remarkable.
Isaac, as somebody who I'm sure eagerly awaits every bit of new data from spacecraft like Mars Odyssey and that the rest of that flotilla that we have at the Red Planet, I mean, what are you most excited about right now? I know that you study ices and surfaces all over the place.
I do. So my main focus is on Mars, and I'm really interested in surface atmosphere interactions, especially with ice. And the poles are really great places to study that. They're actually really good analogs to much of the solar system, in that places as far out as Triton, one of Neptune's moons, and Pluto have surface atmosphere interactions with ice. And there might be evidence for bed forms like sand dunes or ripples. There might be evidence. There's definitely evidence on Triton for seasonal processes. And there's these jets that come out, I think even kilometers from the surface, where the just like we see on Mars, but to a smaller extent. So Mars is a great analog for all these things that are happening in the solar system. And it's a dry place. So it's a better analog than Earth is. And it's got two different ices, carbon dioxide and water ice, that behave these ways. They go from solid to gas with no liquid phase. So I'm very excited about thinking how Mars can teach us about the rest of the solar system. I'm always looking at pictures of Mars every day. I have a great group of students who I work with who are looking at pictures and modeling, and they're doing wonderful things. It's a really fun field to be in, and it's great to see all the discoveries that come out all the time.
Jeff, what are you most excited about as we continue to study the Red Planet?
Well, right now, I am following very closely the Perseverance sample collection mission. I don't know about if we'll ever get those samples back to the Earth. That's the plan. But it's got such a powerful suite of instruments that I think we're going to learn some amazing things through the course of that mission. And it was very exciting to see the first drill core acquisition turn out in a way that nobody expected, which was basically vaporized under the drill. It just shows you that there's all kinds of surprises lurking out there. But I think that mission is really going to tell us a lot about this question about, was Mars habitable? Did it, in fact, host life forms? Is it possible it still does today?
Can't wait. And I, as I mentioned to both of you, just our previous show last week, we talked with Al Kangawala about the progress of Europa Clipper toward its 2024 launch. Isaac, do you have other work coming up in your lab at York to follow up on what you've already found?
Yeah, we do. Some of the experiments we did at low temperature, but not quite as low as we'd expect at the South Pole of Mars. And so the goal is to upgrade the current chamber we have that studies ice at the South Pole, upgrade it so that we can run these experiments in there. So currently we don't have all the fittings that we need to go between the walls because it's really cold and really low pressure.
Well, stay warm.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Yeah, you saw that picture. I had scarf and gloves and hat and sweater and everything on. It's cold in the lab, and especially when you're running nitrogen through your hands. Yeah.
And Isaac, I'm a little disappointed. Here we are at the end of the conversation. We haven't heard from the baby.
Yeah, the baby's in the room right next door. I think his mom is doing a really good job of helping him fall asleep. So,
well, extend our gratitude to both of them, and maybe we'll get to meet your young at another time. Thank you both, Isaac Smith, Jeff Plout. Keep up the great work, even when it's disappointing. And we know there are many more surprises to come.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to talk to you guys. Thank you.
Jeff Plout is a senior research scientist at JPL, the project scientist for the Mars Odyssey orbiter, and the co-principal investigator on the Mars Express MarsIS radar, among other things. Isaac Smith is an assistant professor at York University, where he holds a Canada Research Chair in Planetary Science. Back with Bruce Betts in a minute here on Planetary Radio.
LightSail 2 made history with its launch and deployment in 2019, and it's still sailing. Hi, everyone. It's Bruce. Program Manager for the Planetary Society's LightSail program. Your support made this happen. Now we need help to continue the adventure. Gifts in support of our extended mission will be matched up to $25,000 by a generous society member. Details are at planetary.org/SAILON. That's planetary.org/sailon.
There's so much going on in the world of space science and exploration, and we're here to share it with you. Hi, I'm Sarah, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society. Want more space? We've got the latest news, pretty planetary pictures, and Planetary Society publications on our social media channels. You can find the Planetary Society on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook. I hope you'll like and subscribe so you never miss the next exciting update from the world of planetary science.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Here is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. That's Bruce Betts. Well, he's here, but I want to read you something first. This from Russell Vernon in California. Great show. Even the jokes are mostly funny.
Thanks, I think. That's probably an accurate assessment. I'll give you that one.
I use that only as a sample. There are so many people who are saying lovely things about the show, and I'm so far behind in responding to those lovely people that this is my way of apologizing. But yeah, Russell, we'll take it. Thank you very much. We'll take the night sky too.
Ooh, nice segue. So we've got Venus looking super bright as always, low in the west in the early evening. And if you check out Venus on the 9th of September, the crescent moon will be nearby. And we'll make a lovely view. A week later, on the 16th, the moon, no longer a crescent, will be hanging out near Saturn, and the 17th will be hanging out near Jupiter, both of which are high in the east in the early evening. We move on to this week in space history. It was this week that in 1976, which, 45 years ago, Viking 2 successfully landed on Mars, following Viking 1's landing a few weeks earlier. And the following year, this week, Voyager 1 launched into space.
Still trucking on. I wasn't there for the Viking 2 landing, but I was there for Viking 1, and what one of the greatest days in my life for a lot of other people as well.
You were hanging out at JPL, like interviewing people way back when.
I was, for my college radio station. My two buddies and I were standing with Ray Bradbury, among other people.
No wonder it was the greatest day of your life.
Well, that was good. But, you know, I saw Ray pretty frequently, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
It was this landing on Mars thing that kind of got us, you know, excited.
Well, yeah, it doesn't happen just every day, particularly in 1976. It was the first one. Successful. I like it. You know what else I like? Random space facts!
I guess you do like it.
I do. Of course, most of the planets in our solar system in English are referred to by as Roman god names. In Greek, modern Greek, in Greece, the planets are called by their Greek god counterparts. So, for example, Neptune is called Poseidon.
Why didn't I know that? I should have known that. So Jupiter is Zeus?
Yes, Jupiter is Zeus. It's pronounced somewhat differently that I can't recreate, but it is Zeus.
Dr. Zeus?
Yes, they've given him a PhD, or is it an MD? I always get confused. I think Zeus can have whatever he wants. And Saturn is Kronos. Uranus is just confusing because it's a Greek version of a Roman. It's a Roman version of a Greek guy. Anyway, Uranus is a mess. But yeah, and Mars is Aries, Venus is Aphrodite. I think we've tidied them all up now.
Yeah.
All right, we move on then to the trivia contest. And I asked you, how many orbits of Saturn did the Cassini spacecraft complete?
Here's an answer from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild in Kansas. Cassini circled Saturn in an orbit underscored by going round a lot of times, I think 294. Enceladus and Titan got their data all derived. And in the end, Cassini took that final deep, deep dive.
Nice.
The poet says, 294. Is that what you were looking for?
That is what I was looking for. Now, as some listeners pointed out, you could make different assumptions and maybe edge it to 293, so I'll accept either. But I was looking for the official JPL value of 294.
Almost everybody responded with that number, and there were a few who gave us the 293 as well, some of whom said, hey, I found it on your website. Well, okay, we'll take care of that, but at least it's only off by one. And it is, as Bruce said, open to interpretation. Here's our winner, a first-time winner, but he has entered many, many times, Christopher Lowe. Christopher, you are going to be the first to receive those Chop Shop Store robotic spacecraft posters, the poster, I should say, singular, of your choice. And you can choose from among a group, including the three new posters for Juno, Pioneer, and Viking that are currently in development. That Kickstarter campaign, if you're catching this show early, is still underway at chopshopstore.com. And we thank Thomas Romer, the guy behind Chop Shop, for allowing us to give these away this time around. He's also the guy who comes up with the Planetary Radio t-shirts and other stuff we give away now and then, because all the Planetary Society swag is at chopshopstore.com.
So I find it surprising, actually, that it's only 294 orbits, considering it orbited Saturn for roughly 13 years. So they were long orbits, as they figured out all the clever, clever orbits they used to study different latitudes of Saturn and different moons and et cetera, et cetera.
A number of people pointed out the same thing. They were surprised that it was so few, but they certainly got a lot out of every one of them. We're ready for another one of these.
All right. As of the day this episode comes out, September 1st, 2021, how many spacecraft are docked or visiting the International Space Station? Huh. So we're not counting CubeSats that are hanging out on board. We're not counting the International Space Station, but we're counting anything that carries cargo or crew back and forth to the space station. How many spacecraft are docked at the space station as of September 1st? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Thank you for that clarification and for that question. You have until September 8th, Wednesday, September 8th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer for this one and win yourself a CubeSat. No. how about...
No.
We're giving them away. How about a rubber asteroid? That is to say, a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid. Somebody asked me, why don't we roll the R in asteroid either? You want to try it?
Yeah. Rubber asteroid.
That sounds very cosmopolitan somehow. Anyway, that'll be yours if you're the one chosen by random.org. And with that, we are done for yet another week.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think of your favorite word to roll your R's in. Thank you and good night.
I'm really very grateful to Dr. Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. Darn, no R's in there. Who joins us every week here for What's Up? Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members. Roll on up to them at planetary.org/join. Mark Hilverda and Jason Davis are our associate producers. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.